So everybody just listening, we're just kind of getting used to this new setup. We set up a totally new room with we're kind of thrown off by our sultry voices in this new kind of era we got going on.
Yeah, I'm listening to like all the breathing. Like I can hear all the breathes and everything and all the like intricacies. I feel like I'm doing a semi ASMR video, and it makes me feel slightly weirded out, but also interested.
Interested is always the best, my friend.
Truly. I don't know if I can keep this on the entire time. It's just
No. If it throws you off, you can totally take it off.
I'm going to be distracted. I'm not going to be listening to what you say. I'm just going to be like, it just
right, looking at hearing your voice.
Yeah, I'm going to be falling asleep. It's like, I feel like you should do, you know how like James Earl Jones just does a whole like, fall asleep to James Earl Jones.
The ASMR, James Earl Jones style. Yes,
fall asleep to Mark Laird. Just like, listen to the sultry voice of Mark.
Oh my gosh. I wonder, he must make so much money doing those ASMRs, man.
Mm-hmm.
Ridiculous amount
of money. It's weird how you think he was a lisper before everything.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. But he has such a, I don't know, if I was him, I would be making so much bank like he is on that thing. He's got the best voice ever for that stuff. It's so iconic, too.
It's beautiful. I mean, like, Darth Vader, of course, but he's done, like, he's been in a bunch of plays. He did the play that Denzel Washington turned into a movie, Fences.
Yeah, Fences, yeah. Exactly.
He did that one. I didn't see the play. I never went to the play, but I saw a bit clips of his performance in the play. Like, whoa, I did not know he was a stage actor beforehand. Like,
Oh my gosh. He's phenomenal. Like in that, I think I saw the same clip you're talking about on YouTube. They've got like a brief thing from when I didn't see the play. It's on Broadway or whatever of him doing Fences, but I think I saw a clip, maybe he was at the Tonys or something like that. And they did like a highlight performance of like one sequence.
Yeah.
And I thought he was better than Denzel. I'm going to say it right here.
Really?
Yeah. Denzel's phenomenal, but I think James Earl Jones is that character is, to me, hits that character, you know?
Really, okay. I can respect that. It's hard for me to say
love Denzel. Don't get me wrong. I love Denzel. I do not hate him at all. I love his performance.
I was just saying that you hate a lot. No, not at all. Denzel.
I just think that in that role, for some odd reason, James Earl Jones hit it for me a little bit out of the park. Granted, I only saw that one sequence, so it's not like the rest of the play could have been whatever. But
no, I can respect that. I mean, it's based off a stage play.
Yeah.
So maybe I've never seen Fences, so I don't know how much of that translates to
the movies. As far as from my memory, it was very little changed. I mean, it was the exact same script, everything like that, from the stage play to the film version.
Yeah. How many movies based off stage plays are there, or how many can you think of? Because I can only think of like, I'm sure there's plenty. I mean, we had talked about it a little bit before the podcast.
I feel like recently there has been a couple movies that came out that were plays to begin with. They translate. Oh, The Whale, right there.
Oh, yeah, you're right.
Yeah, The Whale just came out.
Freaking Frasier.
Yeah. Did you see that, by the way?
Nope, didn't see it.
Oh, you haven't seen it yet. Honestly, man, don't get me wrong. I think it's great, but there's a thing that happens. Maybe you feel the same way.
Mm-hmm.
If something is talked about a bunch, it gets overhyped.
Yeah.
And I'm not saying that this was, well, I guess I am saying, for me, getting into it, it's a little bit overhyped. It was fantastic, don't get me wrong. His performance is great. All the other ensemble performances, everyone killed it, I think. They did such a good job at their specific roles. But it does, it's hard. I have never done it, and I'm an amateur audience member critiquing something that I've never done, so, you know, hell with what I'm saying right now, but I feel like as a viewer, it's easy for you to see what's been adapted to a film version from a stage version. Cause it's really hard to do and do it well.
Mm-hmm.
In the back of my head, the hard thing is not to be like, oh, that looks like it's from a play, or that's unmotivated. Like that's a weird thing that's happening. Do you understand what I'm saying?
No, I feel like the cinematics would be the hardest part of that.
Yeah, exactly.
Plays are, I don't know all the intricacies of plays, but plays are there for the actors. The actors bring that to life.
Mm.
Not necessarily the cinematics of everything, like the camera angles, all of that stuff is not necessarily thought of in a play, and you have to bring that to life and make it look cinematic for a feature film.
Yeah.
And so that stuff might be difficult. And that's what I was thinking of Fences. Like, it looks like a good production. It looks like a good movie for the actors, but how is that going to translate to the movies? And I haven't seen The Whale, so I can't, and I haven't seen Fences. So maybe I'm not the right person to talk about this. Yeah. But that's what immediately what I think of. And I think one person that does it correct is Quentin Tarantino. Because even him himself, he wanted to do plays for the longest time. He wanted to be a stage
director. Dude, I had no idea. Do you really?
Yeah. Or he wanted to be a stage director. He wanted to be, I don't want to get the facts wrong. He definitely wanted to be an author.
Okay.
And we talked about this before the podcast. He did a stage recording or a stage read of The Hateful Eight. And a lot of that movie actually kind of does feel like a play or could be a play. The fact that some of that stuff happens at the end of the movie, I would love to see like an actual
I would love to see the play version of that. That's pretty crazy. I mean, I guess it makes sense because it's all self-contained. I think Quentin Tarantino is really famous. I think like Reservoir Dogs, although... That being said, I've only seen clips of Reservoir Dogs. Can you believe that?
You've never seen Reservoir Dogs.
Never seen the full.
I guess I can't really get. I can't get too mad. I've never seen The Godfather, but yeah, I can't get too mad.
Touché. Fair.
But fair, no, it's.
Yeah.
I can't spoil anything about Reservoir Dogs for you. It's a good movie. It's not as best, it's a good movie. And it's definitely...
Well, it's like his first like debut big thing, right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
But shockingly good for how good of a first movie. He uses location to a T. He uses actors to a T. Every expense workaround, which you can definitely tell, like there are areas in the movie where they kind of jumped around like the expensive scenes.
Yeah.
It all makes sense within the film, and it's all very... logical and character driven. And so even with the indie setting of like, maybe they might be trying to avoid like some of the expensive shoots, like it's still witty and fun throughout the entire time. It's a good movie. That's my review of Reservoir Dogs. back to you in the studio.
Right. I got to check it out, man. But dude, as I see you sipping this and I've already taken a couple sips, dude, Jacob, thank you again. For this amazing rum, man.
Thank you. Thank you, Jerry, the one who actually recommended this stuff to me.
Shout out to Jerry, by the way, guys. Shout out to Jerry.
Shout out to Jerry. Thanks, honestly, Jerry.
I don't know how you pronounce it, but we're going to go with Kimiche.
It's Kaniche. If you can read this,
Kaniche.
Kaniche rum. Thank you, Jerry, for this. If I'm not pronouncing that correctly, I'm very sorry. But yeah, this podcast is not sponsored by that.
No, but it is great tasting, by the way. We have no money invested in this at all, but it is
it's really very good.
First time I've ever had it. It's fantastic. But yeah, so we talked about the dogs. The one thing we were talking about before this that I really wanted to get in with you, and this is going to be a way left field segue, but it is nuts right now what is going on culturally and just technologically with AI. Like... How do you... Okay, so first of all, I don't know if I've had a lengthy conversation with you about, like, ChatGPT. Have you ever played around with that at all?
Not really, to be honest with you, but we did do a podcast. I'm going to do a self-promotion, by the way. We had our first episode on the Couch Gaming Podcast, which is a podcast that you can go subscribe to if you want to do that. Anyway, our first episode was on AI. Now, I don't know too much about this, but my friends who I talked to, Michael and Charles, they were very familiar with ChatGPT and the innovations of that.
Yeah.
And... you know, some of the stuff is it's still like a work in progress.
Of course.
But the way that I get scared is this, the fact that we are where we are technologically right now.
Mm-hmm.
If you told people like maybe 20, 30 years ago that we would be here, it would be such a huge spike because there's been such a huge innovation of technology in the past like 20 years with everything that we've had. I mean, I still grew up in the age of VHS. I'm not that old. I'm 25 years old. And now we have all of this stuff. So technology has had a huge bump in advancements. And now you have AI. A lot of this stuff is still new, but it's going to get better. People are going to innovate the crap out of this. And something we also talked about on the podcast, my favorite thing to come out of that is the voices. You can, change the voices. The AI can recognize those voices and change it into that. And what people have done with that, if they've made the presidents, Donald Trump, Joe Biden, and Obama, and there's so many like channels I call President's Play and a bunch of other channels like that
right.
that have changed these voices and made them where they're like playing Wii Sports or Minecraft, and it's just these two. It's so funny, and like it's funny, but it's also kind of freaky. What do you
think? It's like AI dubbing, right? So they're taking like a video or maybe even an audio file, and they're having like a fake conversation between two people. Or are you talking about like there's a video where they have like Joe Biden speaking as like someone playing FIFA or something like that?
No, it's literally that. Like Joe Biden is playing Call of Duty, and they're acting like their character. Like Joe Biden is like in the corner and is like, Donald Trump is in the side like, Sleepy Joe, get up. Like, we get your gun.
Yeah.
And they're pretending like they're friends, like Obama and Trump are like, they're like bros, like, thanks, bro. And they're like, it's so funny. And then they're like, Sleepy Joe, get the gun. We need you to cover B. And it's like, I'm covering B. I forgot my medication. Over here. It's so funny. And like a lot of that stuff, like people have said like that stuff is like the political divide has been healed. We've been united by the AI presidents.
Comedy people.
Beautiful.
Yeah.
But what do you think about all that?
Well, I mean, like, I think it's, you know, kind of like you, I don't know a lot about it, but as a periphery and just my own like exploration of like the subject, I think is exhilarating and terrifying. And I know recently, you know, people much smarter than I am, like Elon Musk and a bunch of other people that actually are on the forefront of this tech, wanted to put a pause on it for, I think, a 6-month period, just so that society could catch up to the innovation. Because there is a fear, from what I understand, of, and I'm going to totally fuck this up, but there is a fear that there's something that's going to happen called the drift, where technology advances exponentially, right? And with AI, it's almost like a rocket ship exponential growth. And so when that happens, there's a fear that already it's outstripping society's innovation, but because of that rocket ship, it's going to outstrip it so much more so that we're not able to keep up, to the point where it really has a negative effect on a lot of society that we can't just keep up with. So
Skynet, we're going to die.
But I mean, there is a fear, you know, I don't know how much into the sci-fi like freakish tinfoil hat realm you want to go to, but there is a genuine fear. I know everybody and their mother is talking about AI right now. It's such a hot topic, but there is a fear that, you know, runaway AI, where, you know, it becomes sentient and starts to think for itself, and the possibility maybe that it already is now sentient and thinking for itself. You know, I'm not smart enough to really calibrate or understand that, but once it gets there and there's no need for us, and even worse, if someone tells it to do something and humanity or civilization is in the way, that it is at such a level, because at that point it'll be learning from itself, able to create other copies of itself that can do other things that also can learn from itself. And so there just won't be any need for us, and also will be a detriment to the task that it is trying to do.
Yeah.
And so that is, I think, the biggest fear. And of course, we as humans were like, oh, well, we can program it to have fail safes. But I mean, like, what if there's already workarounds with ChatGPT where people literally are finding ways to tell it to do things outside of the already controls put on it.
Yeah.
And so that is kind of the scary thing. However, I also know that it will be impossible to curb or slow down, because it gets into like a military defensive thing. So it's whatever country gets the technology first is probably the safest from being attacked by another country. And it's there is a motivation for military defense to be the first one to have this technology. And so if anything, every single other country since Pandora's box been open with AI is stepping on the gas to try to get to that, almost that sentience or that AI that can do all
this
stuff.
It's like they've uncovered a treasure, and we need to, like, okay, everybody calm down. We need to figure out how to distribute this and figure out how this works before it gets too out of hand. Because that's the issue with the free market. I'm an American fan. I love individual freedoms and stuff like that. But with the free market, you give you kind of roll the dice when it comes to that. You release AI into the public, you get fun videos like the presidents playing Minecraft. That's awesome. But you also run into dangers. And there could be very severe consequences to that.
Exactly. I mean, when you give everybody essentially you're giving everybody the tool to do whatever they want. I mean, truly a limitless possibility, because this thing will act as, you know, whatever it is, assuming a whatever desire that or task it is given. And so you get the freak thing is like, yeah, we can cure cancer with this. And it can, from what I understand, it's already leaps and bounds aiding in curing a bunch of diseases on the forefront of medical stuff.
Wasn't there an article out as of recently, like AI cures cancers in like a few minutes or like 10 minutes or something? Like, yeah. I'm sorry, what?
Yeah, exactly. And I didn't read much past that headline, and I took it as just a headline because, you know, I feel like that would be a huge bigger news than that. But
yeah, I mean, on a complete side note, like you read so many headlines, so many things, it's like you don't know what's real anymore. Like you go online and just read a random article, it's like this person kills this person, or like there's a nuke over here. It's like I don't even know what's real anymore because there's so much crap out there. Like, so yeah, on that end is like, do we even know if that's even a real thing? If the AI actually did cure cancer? We don't know.
So right, exactly. But you know, on that front, it could do all those positive things it did sure. And I think that once it gets that level, it'll be able to solve all these things. You know, maybe we'll be able to find out how we can, you know, leave our solar system, do whatever. I mean, you can go crazy with that stuff. But like you're saying, and like we're getting at, is there's a fear that if you are given if everybody has access to this limitless tool, what happens with someone that maybe isn't, you know, is suffering maybe mentally and wants to create a bomb? You know what I mean? Or have the plans to create a nuclear reactor or something like that, that really could be a detrimental thing to all of humanity. What happens when, you know, you tell it to hack into a certain government, or you tell it to, you know, tell me how to make a homemade EMP to knock out power somewhere, something like that, where it totally could be a recipe for disaster. It's really putting a lot of faith in people. Now, adjacent thing to this that I can think of off the top of my head right now is, you know, right now with the availability of nuclear weapons, we already have certain individuals that have access to a tool that has the capability to be so super detrimental. And thus far, since the 70 or 80 years since they've been created, there has been good faith and, you know, exhibited that has not happened. There hasn't been some random nuclear occurrence. And given the fact that we're humans and fallible, and that there are so many nuclear warheads, it's truly amazing that has not happened yet, man.
Oh my gosh. It's
utterly insane to me.
And the fact that people get depressed, people get sad, people get frustrated, and the human fallibility, the original sin aspect of all of that, could just like press the button one day, like, I don't care anymore. It's not thinking about the millions of people that are present, alive, living their lives. It's just like, I'm angry. It's amazing we haven't gotten a nuclear war already. It's amazing the Cold War didn't immediately kill all of us. It's amazing all of this hasn't happened already. I mean, I don't know how stable the current leader of Russia is. I don't know. Like,
yeah,
and there's it's that whole situation is freaky. Like, remember, like originally where they were threatening nuclear war. I mean, the war is still currently going on. I don't know. I haven't even been 100% updated on that, but there've been several talks of like nuclear war in Ukraine, nuclear war in Russia, and like all of that stuff. Like, that's freaky. It's always freaky.
It is. And I don't know how far you've looked into that. I think that's a great thing to get into that as well. So I guess in essence right now, I wouldn't even say we're in a cold war. We're kind of in a proxy war.
Yeah.
That's, you know, cause we're funding this meteor, you know, being the Ukraine in this scenario, but we're funding them as a that is, you know, contributing to the proxy war with us, between us and Russia. We're not necessarily at like a full on war, but it's kind of like a proxy war. We're entertaining right now, and it's terrifying. I don't know what the end result would be. Obviously, I think that eventually the sad thing is I don't see any side coming out.
Turn the mic a little bit towards you.
Oh yeah.
Yeah,
I don't see any side really coming out, you know, head taller or overwhelmingly the victor without a compromise. I think that even though from what we understand, from what, you know, our sources and media sources are telling us, is that the bulk of Russians are not for this war, which I tend to believe.
There was a protest originally, and then the protest didn't happen the next day because they were gone.
Right.
And
You know, it's authoritarian government. It's mm-hmm. the,
it's not, you know, it's not the USA.
Right.
I mean, people take their right to protest for, I mean, we take all of this stuff for granted. And you take
just
the right
to vote,
protest.
You know what I mean?
Yeah. Just to vote. Like all of this stuff we take for granted. And you a lot of people say like we're oppressed in America. Well, you can at least say that in here. And in Russia, you can't do that because you'll get taken away the next day.
1,000%. It's terrifying. You have to factor in that. I don't know how I feel. Like I am. There's obviously, I think it is childish to believe that the people in power know just as much as we do, in the sense that I think they know a lot more. That I think it is to the safety of the not the safety, but I just think that if every person knew really what was going on behind the scenes geopolitically and politically, number one, I think there would be rations taken, and there would probably be a lot of, you know, terrible actions done because out of hysteria and freak out.
For sure.
Maybe it's not a good thing that we don't know, and it's nice that, you know, things are kept at bay from the vast majority of public, because you got to know that, you know, no matter who becomes president, first of all, this is a side note, and I know I'm ranting, but my rant is going to consist of this. If you're wanting to be political and get into power, 9 out of 10, you have to be, and granted, everyone has a, you know, is fallible or guilty of pride, but you have to be very egotistical and narcissistic to really pursue, I think, high level politics. Because at the end of the day, I think it is lost, and it gets overwhelming, and that's why I think people shut out from politics. Mm-hmm. I know I do from time to time, because it does get overwhelming, and the more you uncover, the more complex and also corrupt it can seemingly get.
Yep.
And I think that becomes overwhelming, and people definitely check out. I don't blame them. I do as well. But I think you have to be kind of egotistical and narcissistic to want those roles, which is the exact opposite of what you want in a leader that is pursuing those roles. You want someone that is like, I am doing this because it is not out of selfish gains that I am trying to do this, but for the betterment of the general public.
Yeah.
And that's always the notion that they tell you, but regardless, it seems to be 9 out of 10. It's not that notion. And at the end of the day, even when you go into it, I think with that notion of trying to be selfless and altruistic, you eventually get corrupted by the Leviathan that is lobbying and money in politics, as well as understanding that because we have these two, I'm talking specifically about the USA, we have these two political parties that dominate and control basically our government and therefore our laws and taxes and everything like that. To get anything done, you have to appease one group of individuals and another group of or the other group of individuals. Yeah. And a lot of those individuals anyway are bought and paid for by the lobbyists. And so, you know, there's a reason why on a salary of maybe like $100,000, people in politics are becoming multi-millionaires, the vast majority of them. There's a reason why, you know, and also the corruption that is so just blatantly obvious of insider trading that has been publicized finally by our access to the internet.
Remind me or not.
Thank you for interrupting this rant. I needed to stop talking.
No, you're good. I will say on top, because again, I'm kind of stupid, but I don't know all the specifics.
We're
or
all
anything.
Stupid.
100%. In our own individual way, I don't think people are meant to have that kind of power. I don't think that people were meant. I mean, it's the same reason. You look at Hollywood celebrities, and you look how successful, how powerful, how rich they are, and you think that's the thing to subscribe to. But, and then you see people like, and again, I know that they've been in the news as of recent, but like Jada and Will Smith. Like,
I'm trying to follow you. Think about how rich and powerful, and that's the thing to subscribe to. What do you mean by that?
Like rich and bell, like we see those powerful people, like those people in Hollywood who are so rich and so glamorous. We see on TV, we see on movies, and like I want to be like that. I want to be.
Oh
like
yeah,
that.
We idolize them. Yeah, we idolize that.
And then you get a regular person that's like you and me in that situation.
Yeah,
and I don't think that we're really meant to have that kind of idolization or power. You have so many people like idolizing you, saying you're great, saying you're fantastic, and that. it has to get to you to a certain degree. It has to mess with your mind a little bit. Maybe you actually think you are that amazing. Maybe you think you can't mess up. And you see those individual people and you idolize them, or other people idolize them, and they're just as flawed as us. They're just flawed human beings. Back to Will Smith and Jada Smith. They're a very flawed couple. You see people in Hollywood getting divorced all the time.
Right.
I feel like the current runtime for people getting married in Hollywood is like a year. There's been people who have been married for like a few weeks, man. It's ridiculous. Like, what are you doing? So, like, yeah. Maybe the same thing goes for people in power in the United States. And the fact that you are on camera the entire time, the fact that you have so many people idolizing you, the same, and it goes for both sides, Donald Trump, Joe Biden, you have so many people idolizing you, that's going to get to you. That's going to get the fame, that all that's going to get to you.
So, yeah, I mean, like, basically all that attention corrupts you, and then eventually you start to be, the ego gets in the way, right? So then I feel like we're all, there's no way. Dude, just think about this. You're a child star, okay? Whether you're a singer, actor, whatever.
Woo.
And all of a sudden you're given all this attention.
Yeah.
You're giving all this money. You're getting all these adults around you not saying no. This is the age-old story, right? Everybody's probably familiar with this. But it helps to reiterate how all of that power and attention, of course you're going to get corrupted by it. It's not necessarily, you don't have a mentor with you that is usually relating to you or explaining to you how to act in that certain way, because there's such a small percentage of people that have ever had that same experience. And even them, everybody's individual experience is different. So it's super difficult.
It's like a king back then when all that you had was like the family line.
Right. But at least you had your parents still that were above. Yeah. If it was, hereditary, whatever. It was a good
family. But like, even then, like the next in line is your son.
Yeah.
And as your son, when you die as king, your son is going to be king, or your daughter is going to be queen, yada, yada, yada. And maybe if you raise them well, they'll work out. But at the same time, that son or daughter is going to grow up in a monumentally different way than everybody else. They're going to grow up with authority, and this is all mine. And if you don't raise your child well, they're going to become turds.
Absolutely, dude.
Yeah, and same thing for Hollywood.
Yeah, exactly. Well, I mean, for lack of a resource or a mentor or mentee, for sure, you're going to be, it's just a recipe for disaster. Mm-hmm. You're not set up to succeed in that essence. So that happens. And then when you get, circling back to the politics thing, I mean, when you get these people in power that, they go in with the right intentions, usually you would hope that these people that are running, and at the end of the day, it is utterly insane to me that if you think about it, and I don't know what a better way to do it, I'm for the democracy, don't get me wrong, but, we freely as a society, based on a popularity contest, give someone so much power over the individual lives. And it's we sit back there on our couch with our popcorn, maybe a drink, our pizza or whatever, we're watching, and we're basically like, entertain us and make us choose you. And of course these people are going to lie, and of course these people are going to get up there and tell you exactly what you want to hear.
Yeah, I'm going to make this happen. And while they're in office, like 4 years go by, where was that thing that you promised?
Yeah, right, exactly. And that's, I mean, I think everybody is aware of right now. I mean, you're on the political, the candidacy road when there are in the primaries and you're listening to all these speeches and stuff like that, the vast majority of them are promising things. They know they might even actually, I take that back, they might have the intention of doing these things, but the vast majority of stuff, maybe they know, they're not going to execute on. Also, you run into the factor of, we kind of alluded to this earlier in the conversation, but once they get into power, they're let known all the stuff that the public isn't made aware of really what happens behind the scenes.
Yeah.
And that probably impedes a lot of their, or at least I like to think that that's the reason why some of their stuff isn't done, probably against my better judgment. It's probably because they just promise things, whatever, to get them elected.
Yeah.
Because
I mean, you look at Obama when he was in office, like 8 years of that. And he was like, at the end of his office, he like grayed hair, horribly worn. Trump looked the same. And Biden, I feel like will be, in a casket by the end. Cause he's like going,
how nuts is it that Trump looked the exact same? You would think about any normal person, the amount of stress and just absolute terror that you would go into. I mean, as an empathetic individual, when you're every single decision decides, if not a thousand lives, 100 lives, or you know, tens of hundreds of lives. I mean, you know, anything. And the fact that you're not, that's why everybody goes gray. I mean, the amount of stress you get, not to mention, you know, I think about it almost like a, maybe this is more conspiratorial, but I go deep in the sense of like 4D chessing it, in the sense of, right? But I go deep in the sense of like, it would not be advantageous for a country to have their leader appear weak in any way. That means even sick.
Yeah.
So like, they're probably pumped with so many drugs and steroids to keep them from catching illness constantly, which that can't help the human body at all.
No.
There are so many factors that happen.
Yeah, you have to keep this guy like awake because he is the essentially the leader of a country. And like, I know there's like separation of powers. President doesn't have all the power in the world. He still has to contend with everybody else. But at the same time, like, people are looking to that guy. That's still like the figurehead of the country.
Yeah.
It is hilarious that Donald Trump looked the same. But I feel like he's used to that. I feel like he runs like 16 businesses at the same time.
You know, that being said, yeah.
Because he's like, he's already used to that. Like, also, I feel like part of his ego just like keeps him alive. Is like, does he like wake up in the morning and is like, well, I'm the best. Let's continue to do the best. I don't think he wakes up thinking I probably messed up. Like, I don't think he thinks that.
There is definitely an exuding arrogance that he has, and it comes from being, at least the appearance of being successful for so many years, for decades, right? He's been, had this billionaire status, and basically in the eyes of, up until he ran for political office, I think that he was, you know, the apprentice guy. He was like worshipped for not only his, in the business circles of, you know, his appearance of being very good at business, and then on the apprentice side, his appearance of being really good at entertainment, and you know, he was always kind of fawned over, and you know, had best-selling books for his, what
everyone
he did.
Loved him. He was on talk shows up until he became president, and then he wasn't on any talk shows.
Right, and but what I'm saying is, he's just had this, you know, his ego has been fed for so long that, of course, when he wakes up, you know, he's probably thinking, yeah.
How can you wake up with that type of hair and say, like, I'm the best?
Dude,
you
the hair. In the,
what is that? It's not even hair. It's
a little
wig.
Animal. It's an animal that lives up there, dude.
It's a little animal. It's like if you, like, rough it, like, you, like, start flicking it, it's going to be like, hey, it's going to hit you. It's going to say, stop it.
Exactly. You know, a night before bed, he feeds it a couple, you know, crumb. It is a spectacular hair.
It's just snoring in bed. Like, Donald Trump is, like, his hair, like...
Dude, it is insane. It's a work of art, believe me. They'll probably have it in the Smithsonian after he's gone.
Oh, true. I had the one episode where he was on, I don't know if it was Jimmy Kimmel or a different talk show. It was one of the terrible ones. But he was on the talk show. This was right before the election and everything. And one of them said, like, can I, like, fluff your hair? And they're like,
I think I saw this clip. Yeah. Yes.
I want to do that so bad. I want to fluff his hair.
Yeah.
I want to just, like, I want to run my hair through it. Like, what is this made of? Is this fake? What is this?
They had to have talked to him beforehand. Like, hey, I want to do this to you. And he's probably like, yeah, get the glue in there. You know what I mean? Or whatever he needs.
Truly.
But, you know, it is what it is. It's crazy, my man.
Mm-hmm. You can say whatever you want about the presidents, but the last two have been very entertaining.
Oh, yeah. I think, you know... It's really interesting, I think, and we always end up having these great deep conversations, but I really think it's interesting how we have not had overwhelmingly, you know, I feel like the country has not had great candidates the past couple of times in general. I think, you know, if you really liked a candidate, it's been ultimately like one side. There hasn't been a vast majority of, I think, the entire populace that has been like, okay, these are, I have, you know, even if I hate or love this candidate, at least I understand and there's a acceptability of why they're in the positions that they're in.
Yeah.
From their prowess. And it's just, it's interesting that that has been the case. And also the tactics probably in the past decade, maybe since like early 2000s, 2007, we'll say, just because everybody got a smartphone and like, then internet and data was so accessible to everybody that all of a sudden, you know, politicians, these tricks that they had relied on, or, you know, even the media had relied on to withhold this information or say this information. Everything can be basically fact-checked constantly. And yeah. so we're in this overwhelming state where now everybody has access to information they didn't have before. And so a lot of the, what I'm getting at is a lot of the tactics I think that has worked in the past for someone to succeed, especially politically, because that's what we're talking about. And, but in anything in public, it's totally doesn't new playbook. Anymore. Yeah. It's a totally new playbook now because everybody's got these, the same access to information everybody else has and an instantaneous access, which is nuts, dude.
It's like again, with innovation, with everything that we've had in the past 20 years.
Yeah.
You can't, you have access to that information, but to a point, like, some of that doesn't even matter because because people won't, I don't think the normal person will do their research because, like you said earlier, a lot of this is a popularity contest.
Dude.
Even in like the 20s, I feel like Donald Trump, when he ran for president with against Hillary Clinton, they set a semi-new standard for how this is going about. And it wasn't really a real, it was a debate. Don't get me wrong. It was a debate on policies and everything, but it didn't really become about the policies
necessarily. Are the debates really debates, though? Because
no, it's feeling matches.
Yeah.
It's like pwnage. It's like how much can you own this person online? You get that little tight clip of that. You put it on a YouTube short online, and people are going to go like, oh! And then they're going to vote for that guy because he owned that person in a debate. But so in that end, no one's really looking at the policies of that person. Again, again, we have access to all the information. We have all of it, not everything, but all of it.
Right.
And we don't do our individual research because there's, it seems like there's so much of it.
There's so much of it and it gets overwhelming and it's just easy to check out on that stuff. And that's, and everybody's busy. Everybody's got the normal stresses of lives.
Yeah, man, listen, I can't do all this research. Yeah. I have a job to
do. I got a job. I got inflation super high. I'm struggling here. What? Yeah. I'm not going to go home after I'm exhausted from my long day and put my feet up and open, you know, a political agenda or not political agenda, but politics for the next six hours.
I'm drinking this on the way home.
Yeah.
No, on the way home.
Caniche. Yeah. Shout out to that.
Caniche.
That's it. Yeah, I like that little on the end of it.
Yeah, it's very fancy. I'm a very fancy individual.
Always, always, my friend. but yeah, no one has time to really do the research. And on the one hand, I totally understand. And maybe that is the thing that they're counting on. A lot of, politicians to get somewhere. You know, recently, I don't know if you're aware of this. I found out there was a story about, I think it was a Republican candidate. And not to dig on Republicans or Democrats, but there was just, he was a Republican. And and he somehow got into, I can't remember if it was a Congress or maybe he was a representative in the House. And he lied about his entire background. And lied about everything.
Yeah.
School he went to, like his accolades, all this stuff. And then it was found out about it after he was already like in the position. And it was completely a new precedent. And I don't know how, I know it was like big at the time. I don't know how many people are aware of this. And I wish this is the point in the podcast in the future we were going to have is the ability to, pull up on the internet these stories that I am bouncing off the top of my head. But it would help us if I could pull up that story right now and give you guys his name. But it's ridiculous. I feel like, and it was a major story, but the crazy thing about our news cycle is it's so quick that I think we forgot about it really quick. But
there's a current war going on with Russia and Ukraine, and that's yesterday's news. A whole war is yesterday's news.
Well, the sad thing is it's kind of like the same thing with the Afghan war and all that stuff. I feel like because these wars are not close to home territory, and we're just blessed and lucky that that is not the case, that we don't see, the devastation, in our neighbor's yard, basically, that they're so far away and they're so long because of our attention span, or it seems long because of our attention span, that we become there's a cycle that happens, right? You become aware of it, excited about it. You get overwhelmed by the dramatization of it and just follow it really closely. And then all of a sudden it gets old and you become numb to it. And then it's like, oh yeah, that's going on. And I feel like, that's the saddest part because of how devastating and horrific war is.
Yeah.
It's the most, and at the end of the day, the thing that blows my mind about war And I guess it's the privilege of living in today's society, which has been relatively peaceful, and as well as the awareness of how far we've come intellectually as people. But it is nuts to me that war is basically dictated and mostly started and strategized about by these few individual people. Mm-hmm. And the people that they're commanding and using as tools to get their victory or to succeed in a certain area are the ones that are the ones affected by it. I mean, the leaders at the top usually don't have the skin in the game. I feel like it's not the same as the average private soldier. Mm-hmm. And, this is a separate rant and I keep going on tangents. I'm sorry, guys, if you're absolutely bored listening to me in your car or wherever you're listening. But I mean, I feel like it would, I know that we have people at the top in our government, and I think across the board and all governments would be good. It would be good to have, obviously, people that aren't like this so that they're kept in check. But it's always helpful, I feel like, to have someone of military experience or military means that has spent time in the military at a even medium, not necessarily always at a high level, so that they understand the weight and the gravity that it is that war is. Because mm-hmm. I feel like as, you know, let's face it, a white collar politician, which is mostly what politicians are, they're white collar, they usually come from means.
Yeah.
I think the vast majority of them don't really understand the weight of the action of what war is and sending mm-hmm. people to war and military campaigns and things like that, because they're so desensitized and so separated from it. It's mm-hmm. basically, you know, an order they can write on a piece of paper and give out.
Yeah.
That's the sad part. And also, you know, that's the sad part, I would say.
Yeah. Well, they're not put in a position to where they need to fight physically for that kind of stuff.
Yeah.
They're in a popularity contest still. They're looking to get reelected. They're looking to get more votes. They're looking to get this kind of stuff. And if war is popular or if war is not popular, I guarantee if war was popular, they would immediately flock to that side.
But going on, like, war's not necessarily popular, but I understand.
It's not popular.
At all. Don't be wrong. War's absolutely horrific. Don't ever. No, I do not condone war ever. I don't think anybody should. But I do recognize that there is an industry behind war. And there's, you know, this.
People who profit off it.
There's a lot of profit that goes into war. We have, you know, multi-billion-dollar corporations, I believe, that are, you know, they profit off of war. That's what they do. They mm-hmm. create weapons for war. And, you know, there's a lot of people that get rich off of war. And so, you know, because there's so much money involved in war, I think, you know, you can get conspiratorial with it of, you know, how many times countries are pulled into war because of the economics of war, mm-hmm. because of the greed that a few people or those companies have to go into war. It's crazy. That's above my pay grade. I can't understand it at all.
It's like there's a video that I watched a while back about House of the Dragon. Have you seen House of the Dragon?
Dude, yeah.
Heck yeah. The best series in the past several years. I love
it. Oh, man. I'll fight you on that because I think Succession is up there.
I just learned about Succession yesterday. I have
Dude.
I'm sorry.
Oh, my gosh. You shut your mouth.
I have no opinion. I really don't because I don't know. Anything that I would say about Succession would be fake news because I just learned about it yesterday. I'll rant about.
Yeah.
You know what? Let's talk about how you want to switch to TV shows?
Dude, I'd love to switch to TV shows. I think it's great. We've been hitting on this heavy. I'm sure everybody's completely done with it. I'm kind of over it myself. So, yeah, but you said House of Dragon. I would say I'm going to be hoity-toity. I concur with that in the sense that I think it's fantastic. It's wonderful. I think obviously we had talked about in the past that, you know, Game of Thrones in general was a great show. I think it still is a great show. There was obviously a travesty that happened with the showrunners of that show and how mm-hmm. it ended. I think anybody that's a real fan of the show will totally, you know, admit to that and be of the same feeling.
Yeah.
That being said, House of Dragon
is so good.
Fantastic.
And you know fantastic. What I am so excited about? Because House of Dragons done, the story of it is well known,
yeah.
at least by the Game of Thrones community. And so the ending of that is already set in stone. And if you know the, I'm not going to spoil the ending, but it is like perfectly beautiful. It yes. is a beautiful ending. Yes. And like in my head, I have a perfect way to end this. I don't know. Do you know the ending?
Yeah, you told. Yeah, but you. Well, they don't know the ending probably. But
okay.
But you yeah, told me about what your spec your
yeah
your dream ending would be.
I want to say it so badly. I like to. Like, can I say it? Can I, am I allowed to say it?
Yeah, right. I just don't want to ruin it for people that's that are
fair.
Listening.
Okay, like, you people. Anyway, yeah. I'm sorry. But, you know, it has so much room for, like, an absolutely beautiful, beautiful ending.
Yeah.
And I'm so excited to see how they do that because they've done such a good job so far. And the best thing about House of Dragon is that they are aware that they messed up with Game of Thrones and that they're aware yeah. that the last season was not as well received.
But going on that note, I love how I think for a long time, you know, there's an easy idolatry when someone is so successful with the series mm-hmm. in the sense that like they get a lot of lob passes for more work.
Yeah.
And D.B. Weiss and the other guy, David Benioff,
yeah.
Who were of the original Game of Thrones, not to say that they were bad, but they completely just ran out on the ending of that show and kind of was a travesty to the fans that it's nice as a fan, after you kind of like backhanded me in the face with that last show, to know that you aren't a part of this one, and it's still utterly amazing.
It
you
is.
Know what I mean? And so, you know, the fear that they were needed to put on the same level of content,
mm-hmm.
it's like, you know, I'm not evil or trying to be mean to them in any way.
I'm not
but,
evil.
You know
in
what
case
I mean?
I'm not evil.
I'm not grudge holding. That's what I was trying
okay,
to get at.
Okay.
I'm not holding a grudge or anything, but it is nice to be like, yeah.
In
it can
case
be great.
You thought Mark was evil.
yeah, he's you know, not. It could be great.
Yeah.
There, you said that, you know, it's nice that it's complete and everybody knows the story and really we get executed well. What throws me off, and I don't know how to feel about it, and you gotta tell me your feeling on the matter.
Ooh.
This feeling. Green light that HBO has of making redoing Harry Potter. Dude, tell me about this because it wasn't, I know everybody's talking about it right now, but it was not that long ago those movies came out and it was so
what
well
was
casted.
What's wrong with the movies?
Dude, thank you. What is wrong with the movies, guys? What is wrong? I know they haven't gone as in depth, but they're movies.
Yeah. So when Percy Jackson, do you know anything about Percy Jackson series?
So I don't know about the story, but I have seen the movies, the okay. original movies.
So the Percy Jackson book series is awesome. It's so good. Rick Riordan did such a good job with yeah. those characters and such a great series of books. The movie screwed it up royally, epically, in every way, shape, or form. The actors did a fine job. The whole story was trash. Everything was not good.
Yeah.
And they made a new series that's coming on Disney okay. Plus very soon. Rick Riordan is part of it. There's a reason that needs to be made because the movies were terrible. So that makes sense.
Yeah.
What was wrong with the Harry Potter movies? And they're all beloved. Even the bad ones are okay. beloved. That's not even true. There's not, in my band, there's not really a bad Harry Potter movie.
Yeah.
There's a not as good Harry Potter movie. There's not a bad Harry Potter movie. And also the ending of that is like, chef's kiss. Who's going to replace Daniel Radcliffe as Harry Potter? He's known as Harry Potter. Who's going to replace Emma Watson? Who's going to replace Rupert Grint? None of that makes any sense. Everyone was cast to the T. How are they going to cast everyone else? If everyone was so perfect to begin with, why are you doing this, HBO? Or just Max? Why are you changing your show to Max?
How do you feel about the new name Max? Yeah, exactly.
Stupid.
Same. I feel like HBO was such an iconic name. Everybody's so aware of the supremacy and it already associated with that brand.
Yeah.
We're going to get back to Harry Potter. I just, that hit me. I was like, why Max? Why Max? I know they're merging the content, but now it's just, I don't know why they merged the content.
I don't know.
Because HBO is such a different like field than Discovery has to me. Like the whole brand, the type of style of content, it's totally different. But yeah.
Yeah, I don't know. It doesn't make any sense. And I did see a video of one of HBO's executives. I don't know if this is the CEO. I don't know if this is the main. But What I do like about HBO Max, I'm going to refer to it as HBO Max. You cannot. Yeah. It's like when Facebook changed to Meta. I'm going to refer to it as Facebook because get out of my face. No pun intended. They said they want to go for scripts quality for. They're going for quality over quantity. They're going the exact different route that Disney went. They're going for quality over quantity. They want to make sure the script is great before they actually release the series. And they made that very clear in the HBO series' House of Dragon, in The Last of Us, in what is Zendaya's show again? Whatever that
Euphoria.
One was. Euphoria. Like all of those shows. They want to make sure that the story process is good before they release that stuff. And they're going for quality over quantity.
I think that's the key to their success. Yeah.
Yeah. And again, Disney, with their recent rehiring of their last executive, or what was his name? Not Bob Iger,
Bob Iger. They replaced Bob Chapek.
Bob Iger got rehired back, and that was one of his things that he said they were going to change. Instead of releasing just content,
right,
they're going to focus on the quality before that. And right, they changed their business strategy because of that. And I feel like HBO Max started doing that before them. They realized they had some success in that with House of the Dragon and all of their very well done shows, that they're taking a page from that. I don't know what my original getting to that was, but it doesn't make any sense that they would remake Harry Potter.
Yeah.
I've ranted and screamed and cried. What do you think? Oh, so many emotions.
I'm at a catch-22 with the whole thing. I think that it's way too short of time to want to remake a series, especially a franchise that is so well done. I thought for sure they would have, if it were me, my go-to would have been to explore the world outside of that, explore side characters. Like, it would have been great to, maybe like Dobby's world, maybe Hagrid's world, the giant's world, going all this stuff. What would have been amazing to me, and I've always been curious as a fan, although granted, I'm not as hardcore of a fan as some people. I stopped at the fifth book because the movies were coming out and whatever. But that being said, I thought it would have been really cool to have almost a prequel series of how the founding of Hogwarts was made with all those great wizards.
Yeah.
That would have been fascinating to me. Mm-hmm. Because that would be a story that everybody's aware of, but never seen the fruits of, never seen that come to fruition yet.
Yeah.
And so now we're going into this with having, for me, I'm going in with an expectation that is royally hard to beat, an expectation that is terrified that you're going to screw up these characters who are my childhood, wrapped up in nostalgia. Now, I'm a millennial, so like I grew up with these characters, and like, at the same time, I feel like even, the Gen Zs and whatever, you grew up with them as well. I mean,
yeah, I went to theaters to go see like the last two movies.
Yeah.
One of the last Harry Potter movie, that was one of the best theater experiences of my entire life. It was like Endgame. The entire audience was cheering at the right moments when Bellatrix died. Right. We were like, screw you. When Voldemort died, or like everyone is like in your face. When McGonagall took on Snape. And when she raised the statues and said, I always wanted to use that spell. How are you going to be? Maggie Smith. You can't beat her.
But they were all iconic actors. I mean, how are you going to recast these absolutely? And granted, I'm an actor, so I understand, like, how are you going to recast these people? And I know that those other actors are like, I'm just as good. You probably are just as good. But they are so cemented as not only originating these characters, but so I think that such a strength of those movies to me, and I've heard it said by somebody else, but such a strength, and I'm going to echo their statement, but such a strength of those movies was the casting. It was the casting. The casting of those movies, yes, the filmmaking was phenomenal as well. I mean, you had some directors coming out and doing some incredible work, and like the set design and everything like that, bringing those movies to life was amazing. It was movie magic. You saw those movies.
Beautiful.
But the casting is just a, throughout the entire series, such a through line of spectacular effort. It was just amazing. I like the casting is so strong in all those movies. And, you know, I've seen some ideas on the new cast and stuff like that. And there is a fear that right now with the wokeness, it's going to permeate in that and really kind of like mess up the idea of, you know, what these characters should be, at least the originated as.
Oh, boy.
And so, yeah, exactly. And that, And on the end, God, I think that when you try to appease everybody in any endeavor, even outside of, you know, movie making or politics or anything, if you try to appease everybody, you are doomed to fail. Mm-hmm. You have to, like, you cannot, especially when it's something creative, you have to hold true to the story and the art first. Mm-hmm. If you try to supersede that with
kneeling down to any sort of
fear,
a fear of offending somebody, a fear of not representing something, a fear of doing this, a fear of going against the culture, that kind of stuff, instead of just telling the story the way it should be.
Exactly. If you, 100%, I think it's just a recipe for disaster. And so especially dealing with something that is so, has already been so gripping to fans and has such a diehard, fan base around it. There's just a big fear as a fan that it's going to be screwed up.
Yeah, I mean, it's the same thing with a lot of the Star Wars content. I used to adore Star Wars, and again, I was excited as every other Star Wars fan when new Star Wars content was coming out. And I think a general, but not a huge fear originally was that they were going to release too much. It was going to become so much. And
dude, I thought that too for a while because they were just doing so many series, popping them out, and like the movies keep going. Yeah,
and now we've gotten to that point. We've gotten to the point with Mandalorian. We've gotten to that point with a bunch of the other TV shows that are now irrelevant, that no one cares about, no one needs to see. No one needs to see Book of Boba Fett. The story has become second, and content has become first. I know that's not what we originally talked about. We were talking about woke, but politics has invaded.
Same vein.
Yeah, politics has invaded movies. Politics, and for not the right reasons, in my opinion. And I'm not. That's not saying that you can't make a movie about politics. That's not saying a movie that you can't make a movie with a message. Yeah. But the message has superseded the story in so many ways. And you have a bunch of young filmmakers that I've talked to, and it's like, I want my movie to, say, have this message. I want my movie to have this message. It's like, but if you don't tell a story, no one's going to give a crap about that message.
Yeah,
if you don't tell a good story, a well-executed story, your message means jack. And that shouldn't be the case to say it, to tell a message when you make a series, make a movie. You should want to tell a story first and foremost, and everything else will fall on top.
Entertain, tell a story. The nugget is the message, if that's it. Mm-hmm. It's, you know, a lot of movies that are successful don't really have a big message, but they're super entertaining and super, you know, the story's there. The story is executed well.
Exactly. I mean, that's the reason why I've talked about this a bajillion times, but again, it's one of the reasons why Avatar was so successful. It's the reason why John Wick 4 is so currently amazingly successful.
Dude, I haven't seen any of the John Wicks. I need to see them.
Bro, it's so, like, I feel like the craft in it is the biggest thing. Like, the story is very basic, but the craft in it is gorgeous. Like, you want to see a guy shot by a exploding gun and have him flung through five walls and land on fire, still screaming alive, and run away and then get shot again.
Yeah,
go see John Wick 4. That stuff's amazing. But dude, it is, the craft in that is amazing. The stunts, the set pieces, the cinematography, all of that's amazing. But the core of it is the execution of the story. Mm. It's the same thing with Top Gun Maverick. The core of it was the execution of the story. And that's why people are like, this is cinema. The execution of it is perfect. The story, simple as it may, gets everything you need across. Like, I teared up a little bit in Top Gun Maverick. Like, I cheered a lot in Top Gun Maverick. Like, that movie hit every emotional beat it needed to, and it didn't need to tell an extravagant story. It didn't need to tell an brazenly absurd, crazy story, but it did everything that it needed to do. And again, that's why Spielberg told Tom Cruise, bro, you saved the movies.
The theaters. Going on that tangent, you made me think about Everything Everywhere All at Once and how not only innovative, but how many emotional hits that movie made you feel. So if you don't know, we're getting nerdy here, but Everything Everywhere All at Once won Best Picture this year.
Yeah.
And so, if you haven't seen that movie, I can't recommend it enough. I know it's not probably a movie for everybody. Most people that I've shown it to love the movie, but I have showed it to a couple people that are just like, yeah, it's okay. But I think as someone that, you know, likes movies, watches movies all the time, it's just something different. It's so innovative. They try to do so many things, and even though it seemed overwhelming amount of things that they attempted, they accomplished, you know, all of them, probably not at like, well, even then they accomplished all of them at like a really good level, like amazing level. And the acting is phenomenal. I still kind of am hurt that the, forgive me, because I don't know her name off the top of my head. But
the main actress?
Yeah, not the main actress, but the daughter Michelle, that played.
Oh, Michelle. I don't know his daughter's name at
the,
all.
The daughter's name is fantastic. And it hurts me that I cannot think of her name off the top of my head, because she's such a phenomenal actress, and I feel like she should have won the award outside of, I think it was Jamie Lee Presley that won, right?
Maybe I didn't pay attention to it as much as possible. Like the Oscars, like a lot of
the Oscars has gone. The only reason
we can talk about it in a second. The only reason I wanted to pay attention a little bit to the Oscars is I kept up the updates because I wanted Short Round to win. Because freaking heck yes, I'm so happy that guy's back in acting and that Harrison Ford was up there to give him the award. That's so fun. I'm happy that and his speech was great. And Brendan Fraser, I'm happy that he won. Outside of that, I don't give a crap about the Oscars, and I haven't given a crap about the Oscars for many years.
There was someone else that I thought, outside of Brendan Fraser, although he was great, it's still acting wise to me. And now I'm upset because I can't think of the name, even though I brought it up.
Right? I think the guy who played Elvis was very
Elvis was the favorite, I think. And then Brendan Fraser was like the dark horse everybody kept talking about.
Yeah.
Maybe they, you know, switched as like they were both top for the fair. But then I thought Colin Farrell was great in The Banshees of Inisherin. Did you ever see that movie?
Nope, still haven't seen that one. And I apologize.
No, I recommend that to everybody as well.
It's listening. Really hard for me to see movies that I don't have an initial interest in.
Yeah,
and I just have to build that up. I will see a movie that I have rewatched as of recent that gets better and better each time is Prisoners.
Dude,
bro.
Okay, honestly, if I ever can. I would love to talk to, as well as just, you know, work with, if not just be in the same room with Denis Villeneuve. I think he's such a talented filmmaker.
Oh my gosh.
And he surrounds himself with such a fantastic team of individuals that are artists at the top of their craft, and they, you know, they execute at the finished product that they come out with always is as from a fan, a viewer. I'm just overwhelmed with pleasantry every single
it's
time
amazing
I
the craft it. That he has
yeah
and
dude.
He like wait just look at Prisoners for a second like
dude and the really breadth of everything he did. Prisoners, Sicario,
Blade Runner 2049
yeah man, I don't think that gets nearly the amount of love it should because of the cinematography alone is utterly amazing.
I think he finally won for that. Roger Deakins finally won for that movie.
Oh yeah.
And let's not forget Dune. Yo.
Dune. Excited for that sequel.
But no, he does surround it. Like, again, with Prisoners alone, you have Hugh Jackman, Jake Gyllenhaal. Those are the two main leads. That's already amazing.
Yeah.
And you have Viola Davis. She amazing. Doesn't even play a big role. She's just a supporting actress, and she still kills it.
But she steals the scenes that she's in, dude. When she's confronting Paul Dano, who is, if you do Paul Dano as that character, is terrifying Bro. And great.
Mm-hmm.
Great.
Yeah, that's the movie he played Crazy, correct? Not the Batman. I like the Batman.
You didn't like him in the Batman?
No, not really. I think he was too
He didn't weird. Stand out like in a bad way for me.
It was so like his scene where the Batman was interrogating him was so hilarious because he was like, "No, that's not how it's supposed to get." Like you buddy, you look like a little beta male. Like what are you doing? Like what everything he did was just so over the top and really? Ridiculous that I couldn't help but like I had people who were laughing in the theater like, "What are you doing?" And I don't know. He should have kept that mask on. I don't know. I like Batman's a good movie. It's just I think that was a bit of a miscalculation of what he did in that movie.
Gotcha.
In my not respected opinion, my unhumble, arrogant, I'm better than everyone opinion.
Well, so this is a great segue. So I wanted to talk to you also about like you know you're a cinematographer and you're exploring your craft and you're trying to you're every year. That I've known you, obviously, in the very short amount of time that, you know, we've been together as far as friends, you know, you keep getting better and better and better. And so I want to ask, like, when you're putting together something and you're maybe like your first day of set, are you like, what is the most overwhelming thing to you that you fill with Are you very prepared when you get to set? Are you, even however much you're prepared, is there a moment that you're overwhelmed before you start working at all?
Yeah, every single time.
Okay.
I don't know what the most overwhelming thing is. I feel like the best thing that I got going for me when I'm, at least when I'm directing something, is that I know what I want to accomplish, and everything else is problem solving. And I feel like I'm relatively decent at problem solving. But there are people who do it like way better than me. It's mental. Like Asa Denning, like Asa, my guy, like he does it way better than me. He just knows tech way better than I do. And there are people who just do that way better than me. But the biggest hurdle is just that initial, the first day, like getting used to the entire cast and crew usually is the biggest stress for me, because I have to gain the trust of everybody. I have to gain, like, I do know what I'm doing. You can trust my opinions and doing this and this, and let's get comfortable with this. And like, as it goes along, everyone gets comfortable with everybody and trusts, like, okay, we're doing this. We know what we're doing. We're capturing great content. I can trust you to do what you need to do. I can trust you. You need to do what you need to do. But the initial part of gaining everyone's trust is usually the hardest part for me.
Yeah. I can understand that. It's like establishing yourself in like a, not necessarily a leader's role, but a point of like, hey, I'm a point of authority here as well. And like, you can trust me to kind of bounce your ideas off of and stuff like that. And I'm not just a piece of furniture here. I'm here to help with everybody as well. I get that, man. And it is always, I think it's all like, it's always nerve wracking that first day, dude. It is utterly terrifying the first day, especially, you know, when you're filming out a sequence. I don't know how you feel, but like, I'm sure when you're trying to get near it's a tent scene, right? And it just happens that the shooting schedule, it's one of the first days and you have to shoot this big climactic scene of the story, and everybody's got to be on point. But you know, if you're filming outside, maybe the weather's good that day, so that works. Or if it's just like, we have, you know, the money works out in such a way that we have this stage for this time, whatever. And you have to film that big pivotal scene that first day.
Mm-hmm.
God, it is nerve wracking.
It is terrifying. And I don't know if you felt this before, but this overwhelming sense of I'm doing something wrong. And it overwhelms your mind it impedes you from working on other people. Like, there's a certain amount of like blockage that happens when I'm working, when I feel like I know I'm doing something wrong here. And people are like asking me questions and I can barely answer the questions because I'm like, I'm stuck on this. Like, what's wrong? I just don't know what's going on. And there's that I get stuck on sometimes. And there are other times where like things are going great and like ideas are popping off and people are having a great time. And then there's just that overwhelming sense, like something's wrong. I don't know what it is.
How do you, so on that note, how do you feel like, have you ever had, you're filming a scene, right?
Yeah.
And you don't have much time. So you have to move on. But when you feel like you're like, yeah, I got it, but it's not my favorite, or it's not really, I feel like we should get this better, but we just don't have time. We have to keep moving.
Yeah.
How do you get over that? Because like, that's the worst thing, in working, that's the worst feeling is that, and granted, that's when I think a lot of faith comes into other team members, and maybe where they're like, yeah, we've got it, don't worry about it. But you, as maybe the perfectionist in your artistry, right, you're wanting so badly to feel okay with what you've done. At least you've given, like, you don't want to leave the situation thinking like, I could have done this better. I know I'm capable of better.
Yeah.
And yet that is the worst feeling. I don't know you felt that, how you navigate that situation when you have to keep going.
I just have to put on a brave face at that point, even though my problem is I'm a bit of an introvert. And so that usually comes across around the time where I'm getting tired of talking to people and I just need to take a break. Usually I need to take a freaking break and I just need to be alone for a second and like just recount everything. It's like, okay, let's think for just a second. Because usually when I'm on set, I'm executing the plan. And if the plan goes awry, sometimes I just need a second. Like, I need to rethink how I can start. Like, I need to rethink, like, what am I missing? Okay, that's what I'm missing. Okay, how can I fix that? I can't go back and redo that. I can do something else instead. Okay, let's try that. Let's do that instead. It's trial and error for me. It's because I don't do everything perfect, but it's a process of just stepping back and breathing for a second and talking to other people, talking to the cinematographer, talking to the actors, and like, well, what do y'all think? Because I've leaned on my actors a lot in the past, and sometimes they've had like great ideas. Like I've leaned on Peter like for a scene on Ground Zero. Like, this isn't working. Like, I don't know what it is. It's not working. And he said, like, what if I do this instead? Like,
yeah.
Cool. And he did that, and like, that's great. And it just that reinvigorates me when people are as invested as you and just invested in working at the problem. Because I get that feeling of I'm the only one struggling or coming up with, or I have to do this by myself. But you have other people that are working on the same project who want this to be as good as you do, and I'm afraid to lean on them sometimes. So when I get someone who's as workable with, like I did with Ground Zero with Peter and Abigail, or like the other films that I've done with Keani and Amber and all of the other people that I've worked with on those films, when I get to lean on those people and they present their ideas, and it's like, it's so nice to lean on your team on that and to feel like you're not alone and you don't have to come up with every decision yourself. And yeah.
No, I'm with you. The collaboration is the best part, I think, of working on a film set. When you have good people that you're surrounded by, that's the best thing. Working on any art project, if it's outside of like, there is something that is nice when you experience like an art medium and you're the one creator, even in business, right? If you're the person that's pulling on the strings and it's like you're the mastermind behind everything. Mm-hmm. And if your business is something you can do on a solo level, it's great. Same thing like with a piece of art. If you're like the painter and you've got complete total control of your craft, there's something magical about that because everything is a product of yourself. And you don't have anybody that can screw anything up, right? But at the same time, the catch-22 is if anything goes awry, it's all on you.
Yeah.
And so, but when you run into problems on a massive team project, which inevitably film always is, you are able to lean, especially if you surround yourself with good people, on their, their creative efforts and their professionalism and what they bring to the table. And it usually, opens up something super special and something that you couldn't do as an individual. You can only achieve like with the connection of everybody else. You know what
100%.
I mean?
100%. Yeah. Have you had moments like that as an actor where you just, it's just clicking. Everyone's clicking. And it's the moment like, or afterwards you're like, dude, let's get a drink. Let's relax. Cause we just killed it.
Yeah, dude. You want that to happen all the time, right? Inevitably, it usually happens shockingly rarely, even though that you're shooting for it. But it is, it's the reason why I like to act. It's the high that I get. It's like the high you get, and I've talked about this before, and it's really hard to articulate, but it's like you're manipulating yourself to live in fictional circumstances as if it were true reality, to the sense that there is no contrivance or performance. That's what the supremacy of acting is when you literally, there is no acting. It's just them being. Everything you do when you're in that state is true or real. There is no wrong choice because in that state, everything you would do because you're living so presently, that it is just the character doing that, whether it's like, you're coughing, you're laughing, whatever, that it's not even called for in the script. It's fine because in that moment you are so present. There is no suspension of disbelief from the audience to think that, oh, that's fake, or, oh, they broke character. There's no breaking character because they're just that character.
Yeah.
And it's something everybody strives for. And the great ones really, even when they don't feel that way, they can fake it. Right. That's why it's called acting. You're acting that.
Yeah.
But the best actors, there the ability to be just like an exposed nerve and be so present that they're able to do that. And anything they do is true. It's right. And so when you're in a scene or sequence where other actors are, you're there, or better yet, it's always the other person that kind of can get you there. Or and that helps. If they're bringing a lot of energy and you're bringing energy and you guys meet and it becomes this, it's thrilling. There's no other way to describe it. It's so thrilling that you're in the zone, like you would be in sports, right? You're in the zone and it's thrilling. You don't know what's going to happen, but you are so present and you're so reactionary off of what they're doing, but so in tuned and so exposed, empathy-wise and exposed presence-wise, that your reaction is not verbose or too big. There's nothing that is fake about it. It is true. And so that is the most fun thing. It is utterly insane the high you get, because you cannot believe after it's over, you cannot believe that that just happened. You can't believe, because the emotions that you come up with, the manipulation of your body, the physical reaction that you were exuding from it, you can't believe that that was the case. Or even, and you have to be careful, because a lot of actors, you know, you're riding a knife's edge, because when you pull that, you flip that switch emotionally and you're so present, if you're playing something difficult or that opens up a lot of trauma, you can get lost in it. And it's one of those things, because the physicality or the mental state that you put yourself in can last longer than the scene.
Yeah.
And so you can find yourself, you know, that's why a lot of actors will be like, give me a minute or whatever afterwards.
Mm-hmm.
But it is, this is a tangent, but to answer your question, it is the most thrilling, amazing thing that you want to happen so much more often than it does.
Mm-hmm.
But when it does happen, there's nothing like it.
Yeah.
It's utterly amazing, and it makes everything worth it. And shockingly, I think a lot of people, the medium doesn't allow that. So I've never acted on a soap, but that is much more, that is a different type of performance acting than I would say. It's much more presentational. You know, it's multicam, you're on a soundstage. It's not necessarily the same acting that you would get on Prisoners, we were talking about, or something like that.
Yeah.
That is very much like very raw.
Yeah,
and that's the acting everybody, at least for me, that's what I pursue, is that rawness. Now, that being said, I wouldn't say no to like a soap opera gig or anybody giving me that.
Yeah.
But
you clearly have the comedy down.
I mean,
quick self-promotion for, I guess, both of us. There's a short film, Pit Stop. It's currently in the Houston Comedy Film Festival, yippity-yee-haw, where both you and Peter definitely acted up comedy-wise. And you said, like, you're more of the drama person, but you still are hilarious in that film.
Thanks, man. Thanks. That was really kind.
But I will say, to your side, I'm not an actor, but I've had the pleasure of working with people who just got in character, like one of the best actors I've worked with is her name is Abigail.
Yeah, you told me about her a bunch of times.
She played Rose in Ground Zero, a short film that we did. By the way, it's online, Skyward Productions. I keep doing self promotions. I am arrogant. but there are so many scenes in that film where I got the pleasure to not be on camera, because Ace was on camera, and just see her react and just act off it. And one of the best scenes that I got to work with her and Peter on was in a small room, and all it was I was on camera, I had my sound guy, and it was just the two actors. It was very privatized, and I got to just see her disappear. And she does such a wonderful job with showing everything that you need to from such a very simple reaction.
Yeah.
And one of my favorite scenes that we did was her walking from one room to another. It seems simple, but her reactions to what was happening in that scene sold every freaking second of it. And you got to see her completely disappear and change on screen. And it was so cool to freaking see.
Yeah.
Because she wasn't given any lines. She wasn't given any real things to say. She was just reacting and walking forward, and she did so much with just that little bit.
Of course.
That, like, Oh my gosh, she's so good. So hats off to
dude, that makes me super excited. That's see, that's phenomenal. That like that's great. That makes as an actor, it's like, hell yeah, that's an awesome win. That's an awesome win for somebody else to achieve that. I think well, everybody that's seriously pursuing acting, I think, has felt some semblance of it. There are people that pursue acting, I think, that, like, in performance in general, that they... You can do it for a different number of reasons. A lot of people sometimes... Yeah, granted, we talked about pride kind of earlier in the ego, right, in a different subject. But there is, like, as a person, there is something about... ego stroking that feels good as far as like,
oh my,
you
know,
when you're up there and people are applauding you, it's great, right?
Yeah.
And so that can be a people that pursue acting, I think, at first, or arts in general, whether any art, I think they can get trapped by the notion of tension sinking. But at the end of the day, because this career is so hard, because any art craft is really, really difficult, the people that are pursuing it for years and years, I think there's other things that motivate them, and the motivation, it sounds like, for, you know, people at the pinnacle of their craft is really just I find it goes back to that. When you are that present, it sounds like Abigail, you witnessed a moment where she was that present.
Mm-hmm.
And I bet in that moment to her, it felt amazing. You know what I mean? It was it was such a great thing. Not only did the appreciation that you guys had for her after she did it, but in the midst of it, experiencing that moment as that person where there wasn't any contrivance, where she was just living in that moment, I'm sure it was absolutely a high to her. And I think that that is a chief motivator for anybody pursuing art. Like, at the end of the day, I would assume, granted, I'm not a painter or sketch artist or whatever, but I assume... From what I understand, it's the art of actually doing it. When they're, you know, focused in the zone, and they're putting together a thing, and it's in the flow state, that is the high they get from doing it. It's not necessarily, it feels good of like people appreciating their art afterwards and fawning over a picture they've done.
Yeah.
But it's actually the act of the practice of it that is the high that they get. And I think in the same token, it's probably what I do. Same token, I assume as a cinematography, person, as a cinematographer, you get when you're on set, when you're creating that perfect shot, when you see that shot and you see it being executed as it's happening, dude, holy shit. It's probably amazing to you.
And you can feel it. Like, I usually operate the camera when I'm doing cinematography, and heck, sometimes I even operate when I'm the director. And I know when the shot is going to work, and I feel like this is working. And the midpoint of that shot always gets me nervous because I can feel the shot working, and it's like, it's going really well. It's going really well. It just needs to continue to go really well. And sometimes it just kind of drives, like, oh, for the love. But it's that, like, it's that rare moment. Is like, that whole shot worked out. That was so good. Sometimes that happens. The actor, like, I could do that again. And it's like, we're not going to do it again. That was perfect. It's just so, but again, they're thinking about their performance sometimes, where I'm a little more thinking about like how to execute this than the best technical way. Right. I can feel that happen, and it's such a great, like, ooh, everything just clicked. It was perfect. And all of that, like, it does fill you with a certain high. And for those people, I'm not just talking about me in general, I'm talking about other people, included, it's about executing the craft the best way we possibly can, and that feels so good. That fills me with euphoria, executing something to the best possible technical standard. This poor dog.
I know, he's crying at me. For if you guys probably haven't heard on the audio, maybe you have, my dog is in the background, and it is not his time for dinner, and he knows it. But he is begging so hard.
He's staring into your soul, my guy.
He's just watching me wanting food so badly.
I'm going to walk through this gate in a second.
I know.
I'm going to commit a felony.
But back on that note, though, I would say that everybody knows that perfectionism is an impossibility.
Yes.
But it doesn't stop us from trying to achieve it. Mm. And it's the hope and desire that at some point we have a moment of perfection or excellence, that when that happens, that I think is the thrilling, like, pinnacle of what we do, right?
It's what people who are creative subscribe to do, at least if you're a filmmaker, or I can really only speak to that.
I think it's any art. I think it's any art, though. I think even if you're even a sports person, I mean, it's that catching a perfect pass as a wide receiver. I'm sure it's like, fuck yeah, I got that pass. You got him right in that pocket. You know what I mean? Whatever it is. Or it's like the quarterback is like, yeah, hell yeah, hell yeah. That's going to be great. That's going to be great. And you see that receiver catch it. It's mm-hmm. like, fuck yeah, I just did that. Mm-hmm. Or that running back when he like dodges and spins out of the way and, you know, fucking does whatever to get out of the pass. It's amazing. Same thing.
Also, if you're a video game player and you're playing Capture the Flag and you get all the way from point A to point B perfectly, it is like, this is the best moment of my life. I got to go.
Right.
Awesome.
Exactly. Any whether you're an athlete or any creative, I think athleticism is a creative endeavor. I mean, you're thinking on the spot and reacting. But any creative activity, I think that is the point, is you're trying to execute at the highest level you can and in the spontaneity of the moment. And that's what makes it so thrilling, is when you achieve that moment of excellence when you didn't know it was going to happen and mm-hmm. it just happens. Dude, it's thrilling. It's thrilling, dude. Mm-hmm. Hey, cheers.
Hey, cheers.
We're back.
Welcome back from the break.
Yeah.
This podcast is sponsored by... Not this, because we're not...
Yeah, we're not... We definitely don't have that sponsor, but we're drinking Kelp now. I guess it's a cognac. So tell me what you think of this.
It's going to be the first time trying this.
It's kind of like a...
It's more, it almost feels like a syrupy taste. Subtle syrupy taste.
Yeah, you almost get that.
Oh, that's got a like great a plum, aftertaste.
Yeah, plum kind of aftertaste to it.
Yeah, I like that. That's interesting.
It's nice. It's interesting. There's a depth to it.
Oh, I'm like pancakes in the morning. That's beautiful. This is
nice. That's what I'm getting, that maple.
Uh-huh.
Nice. That's okay.
Beautiful.
I don't know why that got me super excited. I don't know why.
I syrup, dude.
Syrup, right?
Heck yeah.
That being said, though, side note, best breakfast food on earth probably is pancakes to me.
It's hard to disagree with you on that aspect. Nah, bacon.
Okay. I can't eat. I was about to say. Really? And then I was like, no, you're right. You're right. No, bacon's pretty good.
I challenge you to watch The Darkest Hour, which is the Winston Churchill movie.
Oh, yeah.
And see the opening few minutes of the movie where they're preparing Winston Churchill's meal for the morning, which apparently he just ate the most unhealthy stuff.
It's kind of like Warren Buffett, though. Yeah, he eats McDonald's every day or something.
Yeah. The guy, like, he ate these thick strips of bacon, whiskey in the morning, or brandy. I think it was brandy. And then a cigar in the morning. And it just looks at with the bacon, it looks amazing. It makes you hungry. And like, I want all of what he has. That's beautiful. That's a good breakfast drinking movie.
Hell yeah.
Thanks for the opening.
So, by the way, I think that he and Daniel Day-Lewis, best actors alive right now, I think. I mean, there are a couple other people that I find utterly amazing. Like, I think, do you know who Billy Crudup is?
I don't think so. Maybe I've seen a movie of him.
Okay. He's great. He's in, I'm trying to think. He was just in Stanford Prison Experiment. He was in Watchmen. He was in,
I've seen Watchmen.
Okay. But he's great. If you don't know who that is, look him up. He's great. He's like he's not a massive, like, A-list person you see all the time, but he's fantastic.
I'm happy we can still keep a friendship for me not knowing who he is. So dude, thanks. Appreciate it.
Of course, man. But yeah. But side note, I mean, as far as you go, cinematography wise, what are your, like, if you look at yourself, like, what are the next things you want to, like, work on, get better at? Better question. 10 years, you look back at yourself now, what would you probably tell yourself to focus on?
Lighting. It's something that I'm struggling to learn. And camera, operating the camera angles.
You're adept at lighting so far. I mean, with you make things, you make shots out of, you know, rudimentary, what you have sometimes. It's pretty, you know, it's nice to see you conceptualize and pull it together like
Thank
that.
Thank you. Yeah. I appreciate that. The one thing that I struggle with is temperature. And
so for those of you listening, What do you mean by temperature in the light?
Temperature in the light, just like where it matches with the camera, where the Kelvin is. It's good for skin tones and stuff like that.
Right. So you mean like the color of light?
The color of light. Yeah.
Right. So like for people listening, when you talk about lights, this is kind of like the nerdy kind of lighting thing. But when you look at lights, your standard like light bulb in your house, it's got a certain color temperature, and usually they're kind of like a yellowish color temperature, yeah, versus like an LED like white light that you would think of, like, yeah, you go into some houses, you might, you know, go to your friend's family or maybe like an open house, and you see the newer lights are like, whoa, that's really bright and overwhelmingly white compared to, you know, the house I grew up in, which is kind of a yellowish light. And so there's all different types of color temperatures out there, and that really affects the way a shot looks.
Yeah. And I love contrast. I love contrast light. I know a lot of people really prefer this very warm aesthetic. I love contrast and very sharp imagery. That's just what I prefer personally. But I would like to learn a lot more of how Roger Deakins lights
did,
and of how Emmanuel Lubezki, about a lot of those really good cinematographers, a lot more. And I have been learning a lot more as of recent. That's will definitely have helped me in the future, but just more about the intensity of lights and how to rein in all of that stuff a lot more. Because that's one of the things that I've just struggled with in the past is temperature, and also like matching that with the camera, the intensity of the camera. And so a lot of that stuff is something that I've struggled with. Angles is not something that I struggle with at all. Angles is very easy for me. Like, what looks cinematic, I feel like I can capture that pretty easily. Like, in my head, I can, even if I have to go off script and do something different, I feel like I can come up with something pretty easily. But lighting is something that I do struggle with that. And I'm sure it's a struggle for most people as well.
Well, I think it's always like a something you never completely master, right? Because light is such a thing that you kind of, you never like master light, right? You play with what's given to you.
Yeah.
So, you know, you work with what you got and you try to adapt around it to make it like the best thing it can be.
Yeah. And I love one source lighting. I love a single source, to where, like, have you seen Skyfall?
Uh-huh.
Yeah. There's one scene where near the end of the film, where Bond is running away or running to the enemies or something about that, and there's a burning house in the background.
Yeah.
And Roger Deakins did in that movie was he milled this giant rig to where all of these lights were or looked like burning lights in one single direction. But that's how that scene was lit. It was just lit by this giant thing that was this one light source.
I think he did the same thing in 1917. With the cathedral. Yeah,
he did. The burning cathedral. And so I kind of tried to replicate that to a degree in Ground Zero, where we had we were shooting on this on an office, the second floor of the office. And what I was trying to replicate was sunrise, sunset. We had two LED. We had two aperture lights on the outside of the windows, and we had stands that were going up to the second story of the window and punched in. And in post, what we did with those two lights is we combined them into one light and we made it look like the sun. And that lit most of the room with like one light in the background that matched the temperature of the lighting for bounce, just so we can see their faces a little easier. But that like lit the entire room. That's probably one of the most beautiful scenes that I've ever directed. Again, like with Asa, who actually mastered everything and all of that stuff with lighting, like the man killed it in that scene. I love that that kind of lighting setup.
Yeah. And so for people just listening, what do you mean by bounce?
So bouncer fill is an extra source. I hope I'm not going to be butchering this concept. That's going to be lighting their faces. So if we just had this one light, that was zooming into the room, it would be very contrasty, but it'd be very hard to make out their faces because the light's coming from one side of the room and it's lighting up this side, but the camera's on this side.
Yeah.
So we're not going to be getting a lot of detail on this. Yeah. So the bounce is going to be filling this side so we can see their faces a little more, see some detail here.
Right. So basically a bounce is what you would shine something that hits something else so the refracted light fills the shadow of whatever subject you're getting.
Exactly, yeah.
Got it.
That's why you see people in behind the in film sets, they have this giant board on outdoor scenes.
A whiteboard.
A whiteboard. And they are either directing light towards the actor, or they're creating a shadow above the actor.
It's crazy how that can really change the entire look of something.
Oh my gosh, yeah.
Yeah. And you would think like, oh, what are they, a piece of paper or a piece of cardboard has that effect? It really does. Yeah. If you know what you're doing with it, you can paint people with light. The concept of painting people with light blew my mind when someone explained painting with light to me. I was like, oh my God, you are painting. That's insane. That's so cool.
Bro, it's yeah. like art.
Straight up. I mean, like, it blew me away, the fact that you could paint. And I know photographers all know this, and, you know, filmmakers as well, but you all the great photographers that shoot for Vogue and stuff like that, they literally paint with light. And that's why they it's really easy, and why you go to these photography studios that, you know, you see the big white backdrop or whatever. It's not necessarily, I mean, there might be a function of that white backdrop in a certain shot they're trying to achieve, but the reason why they're in these huge, for you guys at home, they're in these kind of closed environments, these big studio spaces, is because it's easier to create the shot you want when you can manipulate every single piece of light or light source around you and have full, almost like godlike control of everything to achieve what you want to achieve. And the irony, though, is arguably the best light you can possibly use is natural sunlight. Because it has this beautiful softboxing effects. And when you're listening with the age of Instagram, I'm sure you might have heard like what soft light or window light, everybody recommends that for your Instagram posts. And it's because of the natural light has this interesting effect of being able to wrap around a subject's face. And which talked about fill earlier, which is having a piece of light fill a shadowing space so it doesn't look like there's a stark contrast between a lit side of your face and a dark shadowy side, so that the light is almost wrapping around your entire face and exposing yourself and making you look like you're fully lit, so all the features of your face can be seen in a very tasteful, aesthetic way. Mm-hmm. Very long-winded explanation there, but yeah, that's just an interesting concept. Just to clarify what you were talking about with lighting.
Yeah, no, you're good. I will say to that end, I feel like I always strive for control, and capturing outdoor lighting can be beautiful, but it also can be risky.
Yeah, because the light changes so quick.
Oh my gosh, you can really roll the dice on that stuff. If you don't get it, I mean, everyone talks about golden hour, and that's the most beautiful light that you can get, but the problem is it's only around for like 30 minutes, and if you don't hit that in the right window, you will mess it up.
Well, interesting nugget on that end. I mean, you look at a movie like The Revenant, which is hailed for its cinematography and the beauty of it.
My gosh, I have no idea how they controlled all that.
No, they didn't. I mean, they rehearse a lot of the sequences, from what I understand, they rehearsed a lot of those beautiful. If you haven't seen the movie, you should probably see it just because it's beautiful. It's like every single frame is a painting, almost like the YouTube channel. Shameless plug, go watch that YouTube channel if you haven't seen it. I don't even know if they post anymore.
Every frame of painting?
Every frame of painting. Mm. It's a side note. If you're a film nerd at all, go look at that channel. It'll blow your mind. But regardless, in The Revenant, this movie, it stars Leonardo DiCaprio. I believe Alfonso Cuarón was the director of it, right? And
Emmanuel Lubezki
was the cinematographer. So, yeah, you can totally understand we are nerding out right now. But this movie is just beautiful. And that's what really, it's shot in such a way that it seemingly makes you believe that it's all shot in one take. And meaning that there's no cuts in the movie because it's so tastefully edited.
No, The Revenant does have cuts. I think you're talking about Birdman. Yeah, that was the one.
I agree, but I thought that The Revenant, they try to do the same thing, although the cuts are just seldom. So it looks like they're just extremely long takes, which they are, but I thought that they're more so they're tastefully edited, so it looks like it's all one take.
Am I wrong? Making me question my own existence right now. For the longest time, I thought there were... Because
I've seen
The Revenant.
Yeah, it's been a while since I've seen it, so I might be wrong too. I might be fucking this up, but
I know there are definitely large portions, especially like a battle section.
Yeah, in the very beginning. Yeah.
That's incredible. Right. It's incredible how they were able to like stage all of that. And there are like, for those of you who don't know, the battle essentially consists of these travelers who are being attacked by this group of Indians. And there are people in trees and arrows going all over the place. And it'd be one thing if it was just musket fire, but there's arrows and everything and all of this stuff happening at the same time. And it's all outdoors and it's in the cold and all of it is incredible. And it's amazing that they were able to do this stuff. I mean, people praise special effects in Marvel, Star Wars. All that stuff is really good and the volume and that looks really good. But the fact that you're able to stage this in the real outdoors and make it look that good, and it's also made in one shot. Wow.
Well, yeah, exactly. 100%. But talking about Golden Hour is that movie, the reason why you should check it out, not only is it beautiful, like Jacob was just saying, but from what I understand learning about it is they would rehearse those sequences like you were talking about all day just to wait for Golden Hour because they were filming with natural light. And so going off what you're saying about how difficult it is filming with natural light because light can shift so much, you have such a small window to execute when you're filming like that. And yet, the reason why people strive for it is because if you watch that film, it's beautiful.
It's
stunning. It's next to impossible to replicate the beauty of what natural light can do at certain times of day. And also, another beautiful thing is, it's also equally difficult to do, or if not, maybe to a lesser degree, small degree, less difficult. Well, candlelight. Candlelight is a beautiful light. Like having firelight and candlelight is a beautiful, beautiful light. And it can be faked at times, but not perfectly. But when it's done, it's done well, not faked. When you actually see it done on film, it's gorgeous. Yeah. And this is, we're getting really into the weeds with how nerdy we are. But I mean, selfishly, candlelight is so beautiful. I would love to, do something with just candlelight. It's just so difficult to do, and you have to have really great lenses and camera to really do it justice, I think. Editing has to be right. It's just difficult.
It is. Yeah. I mean, when Martin Scorsese directed Silence, he filmed in film cameras.
Yes.
And have you seen that one?
Yeah, dude.
Bro.
That's another one that's overlooked. Martin Scorsese, side note, he did this movie. It stars Adam Driver and Liam Neeson and Andrew Garfield. And it is ridiculous. It's a passion project of Martin Scorsese. It's about Jesuit priests trying to proselytize Japan, like feudal Japan. I think it's post-feudal or feudal Japan, very early Japan. And
I can't speak to that. I don't know.
Yeah, and it is harrowing. Harrowing. Ooh. As far as like the emotional thing you're watching these characters. He does some amazing allegories in the movie, but filmmaking-wise, it's beautiful. Acting, top-notch acting. I think it's just a really well-executed film. But one of those that I think audiences, I don't know why, we're not as receptive to. It's a period piece as well.
It seems to tick most of the Oscar boxes.
It's like The Last Duel for me. I thought The Last Duel was phenomenal.
It was phenomenal.
And I think audiences overlooked it. And I don't know. I think Last Duel was mismarketed. But I don't know why they overlooked Silence. Maybe it was because it was overarchingly religious. And religious movies maybe as of recent haven't been getting a lot of
things. I mean, religious movies never really. I mean, Christian movies, unless you're talking about like Ben-Hur back in the day, those Christian epics like the Ten Commandments, those movies were definitely very
good. Yeah, The Passion was the closest thing, but then
I think that was the most popular rated R movie up until Deadpool, or at least the most
and then Joker financially took successful. Deadpool.
But I think with religious movies, like, it does get a bad rep for, like, pure flex. Those movies are preachy as all get up. I'm a Christian, but I don't like any of those movies because they're not good, and they're super preachy. But to that aspect, people may have avoided it for that. I don't know why.
Right, exactly. And it's funny how those genres, they know what they're doing. They've got an agenda. It's kind of like a Hallmark movie, right? Watch Hallmark movie for the beauty and amazingness of a movie. No, you watch it because, like, you want to feel good, and it's like a lovey-dovey movie, and
it's
that's
Christmas time, man.
Yeah, you know, you don't put so much weight on it. They turn them out.
Yeah, I don't know why Silence was overlooked. I think it came out a little bit later in the year, like late December, which was the period of time where you need to be have that movie out to be accepted into the Oscars. So maybe that was the case, but it is a beautiful movie. Like, conceptually, execution-wise, acting, all of it is like, I think it's like top tier, at least the second best Martin Scorsese movie, in my own opinion, just because I think the execution of it is perfect. But going back to what I was talking about earlier with the Candlelight stuff, they filmed most of that in with actual film, but for the night scenes, they actually had to take a digital camera. And because so much of that would be just super grainy, super noisy, and the film wouldn't be as good in low light, because film cameras are generally not as great in low light as actual digital cameras. And so they actually had to film that stuff, because they filmed it with torches and very natural light. They didn't use a lot of, for those scenes where they had torches, they mostly just lit with torches, and the film cameras were able to see so much detail, they didn't need anything really too they much didn't else. Need
any, got it.
Yeah. So
that's all I have to say.
Silence is a great film. It's just really hard to get through, especially that last scene. Like, oh my gosh, that last scene. That's rough. Or at least the last torture scene. That's not to say, that's not a spoiler. People get tortured in the movie. It's most of the movie.
Right. You're watching Jesuit Priests. I mean, like, it's kind of, you know, anything about that history, it's pretty dark.
That one scene where,
But the, dude, the Japanese actors, like the people that are just playing the ensemble locals, are so good.
Like the one guy that was talking to them, who gets
It's been a while since I've seen it, so
no, you're good.
Okay, yeah,
I'm just gonna praise this guy. The guy who was talking to the Jesuit priest early on, and essentially took the fall for them and was executed in the water.
Oh, yeah,
bro.
Yeah.
Hard, it's hard to ever know there was no weak link in that movie. It was beautiful.
Yeah, Adam Driver, I know, lost a bunch of weight to try to do his performance as well.
Yeah,
and not to say that that's, I think people blow that out of proportion when people are like, oh, I gotta see this because what a physical transformation.
Method acting.
If it does, yeah, if it doesn't, you know, really help you and it's just kind of one of those spectacle things. It's like, okay, but
have you ever done something semi-method acting or like just getting?
It depends what you mean by method acting. Like, what do you define as method acting? Because I feel like that method acting, it's a blanket term with a lot of different things.
Doggos.
That's a doggo. We're gonna pause and see if I can. Hello. We're gonna come back to that. So I just said, yeah, so what do you define as, like, method acting? Because that's kind of a blanket term, and I think a lot of people have different definitions of it.
Yeah, so what I view with method acting, at least I feel like I have the popular, the normal person, that sounds mean, the normal person's view of method acting, which just doing, being your character outside of the actual film. Like, you are always in character, and going to extreme lengths to embody that person that you are portraying. That's what I view as method acting. People can go to an extreme length, like Jared Leto and the Suicide Squad, which was not the movie to method act.
That's pretty stupid.
For that, Jared Leto has done. He's been a good actor in other movies. Don't get me wrong, but you're method acting for Suicide Squad, man. Really? That's not the movie to do that.
Yeah, I can't. Yeah, I would say that like There's something to, okay, so I wouldn't say that I've ever, like, method acted, like, Daniel Day-Lewis style, where I'm like, I am that person, and don't talk to me outside of that person, don't call me by my name when I'm on set.
People refer to him as, on Lincoln, as Mr. President.
Yeah, Mr. President, ridiculous. To me, I mean, it's each his own, obviously it works for him, and that's his method, and it works, and if it works, obviously you're trying to get the best performance out of everybody, so.
Yeah, there's the reason he's one of the best actors.
Yeah, to me, he's the best one living right now, and, So I would say, you know, the most that I've done in my small spans of what I've done is, I think there is something too, when you have like a tough scene or a sequence or something like that, that, you know, you're working on, where in the story, the character is going through a trial of some sort and you know, that character is exhibiting like a tough mental space for you to you have to work yourself up to put in that, at least for me, I can't just snap into it. Because it seemed contrived if I snap into it. Because the only way I feel like you can snap into something, unless you just know that character, but if you're snapping into a tough mental sequence, to me, you've planned out what you're going to do. That's the only way you can snap snap into it. So you have to work yourself into that mental space. So you have to give yourself a little bit of time to get there. And so when I have like a, when we're filming something in the script that I know is like the tough mental sequence, I might, you know, start going into it a little bit earlier, get myself in that headspace, distancing myself from crew and other cast mates to try to stay in it.
Yeah.
And in between takes, trying to stay in it. But that being said, I'm not so in it that you can't call me like, hey, Mark, or get over here to your Mark or whatever. It's like, it's not that. It's just like, I am distancing you. I don't want to lose this area that I'm in inside my head. So I am going to separate myself and try to stay in it for the duration of how long we're working, because I don't want to get out of it for risk that I am going not going to be able to get back there that quick.
Yeah.
And so that's the probably the closest thing to method that I've ever done. I feel this is a tidbit for me. If I'm playing like a period or if I'm playing a different person, costume really helps, man. I think that like after you put in a lot of work and like on a character and stuff like that, when you have that person's like wardrobe on, that costume, you all of a sudden everything kind of starts to click for me, and it's like, oh, okay, I get it. I get what this guy is. I feel this guy now.
Yeah.
And if you can, if especially when I've been lucky enough to where, you know, on higher budget projects where the, you know, the set is dressed impeccably, and you don't have to really contrive or suspend your disbelief ever as an actor, which is such a gift, and you can just be. And so when you have that wardrobe on and you've already done the research on the character, you know your lines, and you're living in the space, there is so much easier to drift into just being present as that character would be and get yourself in that mental state so much quicker. Yeah. Because you're not having to suspend your disbelief. Yeah, it, you know, on your side of what the camera sees, it might be all period and look at. You still might be staring at like 30 people and the boom guy, you know, with his whatever, and the camera staring at you, and you're having to do things. But you still, all the objects around you in your bubble that you're within are real to you. It's all tangible to you. You're not having to suspend your disbelief, and it's so helpful. So it's so much easier to stay and also exude the mental space you need to be
yeah.
to do that. Yeah. So that's the closest thing I've ever been to say doing method, like method. And I don't even constitute that as method. I don't know. I think there is a threshold where being gratuitously method, almost you slide into this ego thing, like, idolize me because look at all these leaps and bounds I'm going through to achieve this character. And like, it's almost like,
yeah,
it has become a trope of like doing method to get some sort of idolatry or accolade from.
It's attention seeking.
Yeah.
For most, because I don't necessarily think Daniel Day-Lewis does it for attention.
No, I don't think so at all.
He stays out of the limelight quite a bit.
Yeah, he hates interviews. I don't think he does it all. And even like when his isn't like true, like, what is method, right? Because his thing is like when he was on Gangs of New York, from what I understand, he put like headphones on and listen to Eminem to get pumped up for scenes or something like that. So he wasn't fully committed, but he didn't want to associate his identity with another identity while he was being a certain identity.
Right.
So if he was Bill the Butcher, that was who he was. It was his identity. He didn't want to associate with another identity while he was doing it. He didn't want to commingle the two.
Yeah.
And for him, that is just how he does it. And obviously the authenticity with which he works benefits immensely from his method of doing that. So
100%.
So yeah, man, dude, as always, brother, this was immensely fun. Thank you for having a drink with me. Thank you all for listening. I hope our rants did not bore you and only helped you and absolutely kicked away or kicked the ass of any boredom that is hitting you.
Yeah, right, entertaining now is hopefully the end game.
Yeah, man. Well, dude, always a pleasure. We got
to
do it again.
Thank you for having me on, man. Appreciate you.
Dude, thanks for talking to me.
Yeah, I like talking to you.
All right, y'all. Take care. Bye-bye.
Adios.